This is the Dr. Louis B. O'Donnell Media Summit, brought to you by WRVO Public Media, recorded on November 6, 2013, in front of a live audience at Waterman Theater on the SUNY Oswego campus. SUNY Oswego President Deborah Stanley opens the program.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Dr. Louis B. O'Donnell Media Summit. Yes, this is the ninth year. It's a particularly notable year because of all of these expert panelists here that you see on our stage are alumni of our communications studies program at SUNY Oswego. This year's summit helps our students, especially the up-and-coming professionals in the School of Communication, Media, and the Arts, get an insider's look at where the sports media industry is headed and begin thinking about where they might best apply their skills and talents. The Media Summit is the brainchild of Louis A. Borelli, Jr., right here. Lou, of course, is also a graduate in 1977. Sorry, Lou, I've got to say that year. He wanted to honor longtime Oswego professor Louis O'Donnell, Doc, as he was known to everyone. He was so fond of his students, and they were so fond of him. He was a true mentor. He provided students with good advice as they made their way through college and into the creative world of mass media. His passion for learning and doing became the passion of each of his students. One of Doc's students, Lou Borelli, who went on from Oswego to become a pioneer in cable television, online media, and broadcast production services, is here. He started the Media Summit in Oswego in 2005. He later got together with another good friend of our campus and a good friend of Lou's, Al Roker. You might know him. He is also an alum of this institution. They christened the summit in honor of their shared mentor, Doc O'Donnell. Today we're going to focus on the vibrant world of sports and sports media. Over the years, we've explored topics related to politics, diversity, new technologies, but today, we throw a spotlight on the business of sports and its impact on all of us in American society. Professional sports has grown into a huge business. Its games help fuel the entertainment and advertising industries. Many of our alumni work in these areas, and many of our undergraduates aspire to do so. Watching sports, and we all do it, is enthralling. It wraps us up in the moment, hurls us into those emotional highs and lows. We all get that. The struggles and achievements of individual athletes inspire us as well. Athletic competitions, whether at the school, college, or professional level, build powerful communities of fans. As we well know here at Oswego, of course, we take great pride in our Lakers, our scholar athletes, on every field and even the ice. But as investigative journalist Amanda Ripley points out, there are often hidden downsides to sports. The long-term consequences of sports injuries on professional football players is an example of a problem coming to light after the damage is done. On-field heroes tarnished by drugs or gambling provide a modern-day equivalent to Greek tragedy when their faults are exposed to all of us. Sports provides the ultimate in live entertainment, but it also provides a rich source of stories and commentary in media from Twitter to newspaper to big screen blockbusters, Moneyball, Rocky, also literary classics like Seabiscuit and The Natural. I'm sure today's impressive panel of experts will be able to relate their experiences as they found success in this exciting field, but they can also provide us with insights into the rapidly changing sports landscape. Over the past few years, we've seen an explosion of new cable channels focusing on sports, the growth of online fantasy teams, and growing debate about the value of professional and amateur contact sports. We look forward to hearing about the rapidly changing playing field and to examine some of the issues that face the future of sports media. Our own Lou Borelli, founder of the Media Summit, will moderate this exciting discussion. Lou has received numerous industry awards and was elected to the Cable Television Pioneers Association. As the chief operating officer for NEP Broadcasting, he oversaw the worldwide facilities and production company that supplies all major television and sports networks with technological services and support. He has, believe me, and we all know this, a deep well of experience and knowledge to draw from in guiding today's discussion. He is also a loyal advisor and alum at SUNY Oswego. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to our distinguished moderator, Lou Borelli.
Thank you, President Stanley. Thanks, everybody. We're going to play this a little fast and loose today. We have some questions that we're going to discuss, some of them light, some of them a bit heavy. We'll start with the simple introductions. Immediately to my left, Jay Bieberman, class of 89. You okay over there, Steve? Is the managing editor for sports for Bloomberg. Next to Jay, Donna Goldsmith. Donna, the number two most powerful woman worldwide in sports, according to Forbes magazine.
And my mother.
And she's run the WWE. She's been at the NBA. She is now a much in-demand consultant in the area of sports and marketing. Next to Donna, John Kuchko, WROC 87. Hails from Binghamton, started in Elmira, then moved sideways to Binghamton, and has been in Rochester. He is the man when it comes to Ra-Cha-Cha sports.
Yes.
And on the end, some slacker who went to school here in 87, whose best-known comment is, da-na-da, da-na-da. Steve Levy, who we all know and love, and if you've spent any time on campus or online following sports, you know that the broadcasters here in Oswego are very proud to stand and work in the Steve Levy press box at the campus ice rink. So thank you, everyone, for coming. We're going to start it off with a few questions, and we'll see where the discussion leads. Donna, the thing that is amazing to me, and most people might not understand, and we'll try to keep this sort of above board, but you have worked for the two most difficult men in sports. You've worked for David Stern, mm-hmm. outgoing commissioner of the NBA, and you've worked for Vince McMahon, who needs no introduction and no explanation. Talk to me about what that was like and how you forget about surviving, how you actually thrive.
So you guys know Vince McMahon. You've seen him in the ring. He's not all that different in the boardroom. He certainly doesn't come out to the music that you hear when you watch WWE. But they are, Lou, you nailed it. They are very, very powerful, very loquacious, and very, very intelligent men, both of them. And I feel blessed to say that I work for both of them. They are very different. David is more cerebral, I'd say, although Vince would probably be offended by that. But Vince is extremely creative. I don't think I've met anyone as creative as Mr. McMahon is. And the stories that you see day in and day out, for those of you that have watched Raw or SmackDown or any of their other programs, Vince leads the charge on that. The man is on the road 52 weeks a year. The work ethic there was unparalleled. I've never seen anything like it. David is, I mean, the NBA plays a lot of games, as you guys know, and David is also one that is on the road often. As he's outgoing now, Adam Silver's going to take over, has a similar work ethic. It's a different kind of manager. But I will say that both men had very high expectations. They expected you to work really hard, to dig really deep, and get everything out of every employee. But if you are the kind of person who is passionate about your work. And by the way, I said it in classes I met this morning. I was not a sports fan. So it was a little bit harder for me. It was true work. But the expectations for me were the same as the expectations for the guy that's reading the sports pages and feels real happy and comfortable, and that's not work to him every day. For me, that was a little more of a challenge. But my expectations were that I was going to kick butt just like the next guy. And the passion and the love for the business, because you do love it. Once you're there, you become part of that fabric of both those businesses, very different businesses. But both had strong ethics and created amazing companies, and their brands are so important to them. And in turn, you become thinking like they do. The brand is just as important to you, and it was to me as well.
So at the NBA, you were
part of the initial push to really push internationally. You were part of that team. Mm-hmm. Take us through how you translate a brand that is, I mean, it's one of the few games we could say we actually invented, right? So the NBA brand, a real American brand, and you take that around the globe. What was that like?
So the first thing you do when you want to talk to an international marketplace about a game or a brand is the easiest thing you can do is bring television to that market. And so the NBA and wrestling had both presence internationally. The UK was big for WWE initially on television. Same thing, the NBA had presence. And I'll use UK as the classic example. So you get the television coverage. Then you bring the game or the entertainment for WWE into that market. And so that the fans that are watching on television can now experience it. They can see the game. We played something called the McDonald's Open, which you guys, I'm sure, will remember. We brought that to the UK. We later brought it to France when I was at the NBA. For wrestling, we brought the event to Manchester, to the MEN Arena. So here were fans that were watching us for years because we let it cultivate, and then we brought it to their local market. And they came and they felt and they were part of the game. Then you bring the consumer products to the market. I mean, it's not difficult to say, okay, what's your strategy? Well, we want people to spend money on consumer goods. So after you show it on TV, you bring it to the market, you introduce consumer goods to the market. And guess what? Fans are going to the local retailers and they're buying your product. And so now they're more familiar with the Big Show or with Scottie Pippen at the time or with Steve Nash. They're starting to understand who the players are, who's the talent. And then, of course, more recently, digital followed. So it was there was a real thinking behind it. And I will say, again, looking at David and Vince, the way they went about it was similar. Mm-hmm. And it worked. It worked. And now both of those, the game for the NBA and certainly wrestling, is all over the world. Right. I will just leave you with one other thing. There are nuances, certainly, for WWE. In the Middle East, you can't show the divas. You can probably figure that out. You know the divas, you guys? You don't show those in the Middle East. In China, you have to be very careful with what they consider violence is a little bit different than what you would see in the States. So you modify the television program accordingly, but then again, you modify your consumer goods, your story, your brand message is a little bit different.
So, Jay, interesting, as I'm sitting here listening to Donna, and she is describing essentially a global brand and a global export. Bloomberg, obviously, is well known from a business and financial reporting model. You're the sports guy at Bloomberg. And so part of me wants to understand sort of the positioning where you're at, where you're either reporting on the business end of sports or on sports or trying to blend. I'm trying to understand how you balance sort of the Bloomberg brand with the events and the effort that your team puts in these things.
Yeah, and it is a blend. And the main thing is all of our clients, you know, on Wall Street and around the world, whether you are working in the CEO suite or you're in the mailroom, everybody's interested in sports generally. So what we try to do is provide our clients with information every day that's different than the Associated Press, as an example. They have a lot of reporters there. We have, for sports, we have 20. So we pick and choose our spots, and we look to do stories about the business of sports, things that you're not going to get in other areas, because that's what our clients are interested in. And when I started 22 years ago, pre-internet, pre-everything like that, you know, sports, the dollar signs weren't as big, but now everything is multi-million dollars, you know, whether you're talking about a salary of ball players or you're talking about bond initiatives on stadiums, ownership sales of teams. So we're melding it all together. An important thing for us also, we don't want our clients going elsewhere to get their news. So we want to keep them at the terminal for their sports because they will go other places. And
like where?
The ESPNs, the Ravels of the world. You know, there's a marketplace that's big enough for everyone, and Twitter and being involved in that. We have a built-in audience with 330,000 plus clients that are at our terminal, and they care about the business of sports, and that's what we try to provide every day. I mean, sometimes it's something that the competition is doing, or what we would say is the competition, you know, if it's CNBC or a financial organization like the Wall Street Journal, but we always try to put a different slant on it.
So I'm listening to you and I'm thinking a couple of things. First of all, sports owners are your client. The investment houses that take your product, that invest in sports and sponsor sports, are your clients. You've probably got all of these multi-million dollar athletes, and their advisors are your clients. And I'm just thinking, like, you are fraught with potential conflict.
Yeah, I mean, the conflict isn't that great. I mean, we are always, the news comes first, you know, for us. You know, there are clients, but we want to get the story out. We want to get the truth of any story out. Those clients, they appreciate our task and our honesty. We don't pull any punches. We are accurate. You know, our sourcing policy is extremely thorough. You know, we have to double source everything if we were going to do something that we're unattributing. So I think those owners and the bankers and Wall Street really appreciates and respects the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. So, John, you are unique. Not because you're, you know, like a hell of a guy, but 25 years in a single market, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And you are still one of the few guys in your relative position within that market and then as part of the broader company, aggressively following the quote-unquote local sports team, pro team, which would be Bills, Sabres. You travel a lot. You put a lot into that. And as we see in other markets and in other station groups where sports tends to be minimized, why does that work for you and for your company?
In local TV sports nowadays, it's about generating revenue like it is in most businesses. I think the key to survivability for anyone who's doing local sports from a TV standpoint is to generate content outside of the traditional news times. Let's face it, of everyone here, based on a show of hands, who watches a 6 and 11 o'clock newscast? Hardly anybody, very few people. I don't, and I'm on the thing. Mm-hmm. But what I do is I generate content to air in other day parts. I cover the Super Bowl every year, not just for Rochester, but for 85 stations, all different affiliates in our Nexstar broadcasting group, and I generate revenue by way of vignettes. I put together 10 25-second vignettes with room for a 5-second billboard for a sponsor. They air in 85 different markets. I do a half-hour Super Bowl preview special that is syndicated out to the 85 different markets, and that's where they make big money. And to me, that's the key for survivability for a sports person in any local market. Local sports are important, yes, but not just within the context of a 6 and 11 o'clock or a 10 o'clock newscast. Because like the old print newspaper, that is becoming fast a dinosaur, mm-hmm. thanks in part to the proliferation of cable and satellite, mm-hmm. ESPN, NFL Network, and so forth. You've got to make yourself relevant.
So basically what you're suggesting, which I agree with, is that local markets are seeding the highlights business because the guys who actually own the rights, create the shows, and have more control over that content could just do it better.
Absolutely. Now, you know, ESPN certainly has had a major impact on that mindset in getting away from that. Having said that, I do cover the Buffalo Bills. I'm at every game, home and away. Been that way for 20-plus years. One of the few local stations anymore that hooks their wagon to a franchise like that. ESPN isn't in Orchard Park every day. In fact, often we're feeding our material to them midweek. Right. You know, E.J. Manuel, the Bills quarterback, back at practice today. The sound they run on SportsCenter tonight or on Troy Wingo's show, in all likelihood, will come from a local affiliate. Mm-hmm. So we can provide the in-depth coverage to the thing that's most important to our viewers in our market, which are Buffalo Bills games. I mean, they do a 60-65 mm-hmm. share in our market. That's a big number.
Wow.
Big number. Of all that TV sets awesome. In use from 1 to 4 o'clock on an NFL Sunday, 65% of them are tuned into a Bills-Chiefs game like last Sunday. That's a monster number, and as long as they do those numbers, we will hook our wagon to them.
I was just going to say, you just answered the question, why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. So, Steve.
Yeah.
You are part of the intergalactic global leader of everything that is not news or finance, so it's sports. Talk to me about the pressure of being in that position and the responsibility you and your team have relative to the impact, really the unmitigated impact you have on the sports fan, on the sports business, on the free world?
It's a huge responsibility. And it can be nerve-wracking at times. It's, that's what Jay said about Bloomberg. It's accuracy first. And that's certainly what we strive for, too. But there are a lot of stories, and there are a lot of teams out there. And John makes an excellent point. We can't be every place. As much as we try to pretend we are, we simply can't be everywhere. We have a mission statement every year, as most major companies do. And among the key points on our mission statement is to serve the sports viewer, the sports fan, in every way possible. And so that's what we strive to do. And we try to balance, it's really one of the first rules of broadcasting, entertain and inform. And so that's what we try to do on a nightly basis. But our universe has exploded. SportsCenter is now live, I think, 18 hours a day. In the old days, I think it was live 4 hours a day, maybe, and the rest were re-airs. But what happened is, and that's a great example. So in the old days, when SportsCenter was not in Los Angeles, we would do the overnight show from Connecticut at 1 a.m. Eastern time. And that SportsCenter would run until 1 or 2 in the afternoon the next day. But because there was so much sports news breaking at 9 a.m. now,
right,
trades, injury news, coaches getting fired, press conferences, that forced us into being live starting at 9 a.m. and live L.A. West Coast presence and all of those things. So it's a tremendous undertaking with all the networks. We seem to keep adding new networks. The SEC network now is on the way, which outside of the SUNY CAC conference is among the top conferences in all of sports. And we keep plugging away at it. So, but it's a tremendous responsibility. We take sports, sports is supposed to be fun, right? It's fun. We all love going to games. But it's serious business where I am, and we take that responsibility very seriously because we realize also there's more competition than ever, and we're not about to lose our grip on that audience. One slip up here, we're not going to take that chance, let them go someplace else.
ESPN in the early days was as much about the personalities as it was about the sports because, frankly, in the early days, you didn't have a lot of rights, and so what you were doing was sort of creating this, as you said, this sort of fun environment where sports fans could really be fans. Talk about the evolution of the early personalities and somewhat now, like how do you see that sort of flowing, the more recent hires that have come in, the people that have been there. I mean, you're celebrating your 20th year there. So for the guys who were there before you and for the people who have shown up in the last 5 years, give us a sense of how that's changed.
It's really changed. It used to be big personality. I mean, Chris Berman got to be a mega superstar based on his personality and the nicknames. And the upside of that was, he became the franchise for ESPN, a signature voice. The upside for Chris Berman is he became a superstar. The downside for ESPN is they had to pay him like a superstar. And really, that was the underlying current in Bristol. They're not going to allow other anchors after Berman to take on that personality, to become big stars on their big shows for fear of having to pay all these major personalities. So for a long time, it was Chris Berman doing his thing and the rest of us sort of going along. And then Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann come along and they're big personalities and we tone it down a little bit more. And only recently now have you seen bigger personalities come back. And not so much on SportsCenter, but on, pardon the interruption, Around the Horn, Dan Lebatard show. It's all about opinion. We embrace debate, First Take. Anybody up for First Take in the morning?
Yep.
Stephen A. Smith. I mean, big personalities, big voices. And I think what we try to do now is we try to strike a balance. And that is to have someone big and opinionated and loud, and then someone like myself next to them, just try to get the score right. So I think that's the balance. Again, entertain and inform. You have to do a mix because if you just inform, hey, that's boring and that's dull. And if you just have two people yelling at each other, well, we need some real information in there too.
Right.
So it's a delicate balance.
John, how does that approach affect how you've gone about your duties, say, let's just stick to the local station anchor producing responsibilities? Mm-hmm. How does what Steve says affect what you do day in and day out? How's it changed?
Well, you know, the business from a local standpoint has changed a whole lot with the growth of ESPN, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, we're so driven by the Bills, and my market's very unique in that way. It's not like that in most markets where you do hyper local. Rochester, for whatever reason, just isn't like that. High school sports are big, yes, but they're not like a Friday night in eastern or western Pennsylvania or in Texas or in Florida, where Friday Night Lights is very much real. We're lucky if we get 300 or 400 people at a high school game on a Friday night in our market. Very unique. You go to some of these smaller markets, Elmira, Binghamton, Utica, Watertown, much bigger deal. So Rochester's a bit of a strange market in that regard. But again, it's all about making yourself relevant and surviving in sports at a local TV level. And you've got to isolate areas where you can generate ratings and revenue. And we do that by certain subject matter, and one of which is our Bills coverage. Having said that, one of the biggest stories I ever broke was when we had an autistic boy who was manager of a basketball team get thrown in on the last 2 minutes of a game and nail 7 3-pointers, J-Mac. We broke that story by 24 hours over anyone else. And if someone told me after 26 years of doing sports that would be the biggest thing I'd ever cover, it really was. I mean, it was the ESPN SB Sports Story of the Year. Nobody, not one local station, shot that game. It was a meaningless game at the end of the regular season before sectionals. I get in early every day to work. I had a voicemail from a teacher that left me a message saying, you got to see the coach's tape. I called the coach. I went up and got the tape, and my jaw dropped when I saw it. It was incredible. I said, I got to get this. Let me take it back to the station and dub it. Wink, wink, it's going to take me 8 hours to get it done, preventing my competition from getting it. And I had it for 24 hours before anyone else did. So you isolate a story like that, but that comes around once every 20, 25 years. We're lucky in our market. We've got major championship golf. We just had the PGA Championship at Oak Hill. You own big things that are local, and that's what we've done with, like, the Bills and the PGA and so forth. Syracuse basketball as well.
You know, you spoke a little bit about high school sports. In this edition of the Atlantic Magazine, of all places, how sports are ruining high school. And they talk about how in certain districts, even districts that are not known as like uber sports. Now, you know, like I lived in Texas 14 years. I know about Texas high school football. And I know about all the accoutrements that go with it, the cheerleading, the bands, the whole nine yards. But there are still, you know, middle of the road school districts that spend maybe $350 a math student for math and maybe $1,400 a cheerleader for cheerleading. And the question is this. Now that media has gone kind of global, you've got this, you know, digital distribution, anybody with a smartphone can shoot highlights and distribute. The whole impact on, let's just deal with high school. We'll talk about the amateur college, wink, wink, level in a second. But high school sports, from a standpoint of just the sociology of that pressure, Donna, you've been on the sports side, you've been in entertainment, and you know that at that middle school, high school level, there are guys that are just, they look at those wrestlers or they look at those point guards and they're like, I want to be just like that. Mm-hmm. How do you balance that impact and that responsibility?
Well, I think it's up to the educators to try to do that. I mean, at a business level, there was someone that came up to me today, and I don't know if he's in here, and he said, I know you haven't worked at WWE for 2 years, but I brought my pictures and I'm a wrestler and I really want, and they haven't looked at me. Now, I haven't been there in 2 years, but it's a dime a dozen. I mean, there are so many people that want to be, that when I was there and post my time there, I want to be a wrestler. I want to be a WWE superstar. I'm the best kid on my high school basketball team. The chances of making it are so slim. There was an article in the New York Times, I don't know if anybody saw that this week, that talked about, based on your height, what your chances are of getting into the NBA. And, of course, it said if you were, you know, point guard size, you have one in a gazillion. And if you're over 7 feet, it was like one in 50. You know, you stood a much better chance. But the point is that it is such a tough road. And I think it's up to our educators that have to make it clear to these kids. And, of course, their moms and dads. But at the end of the day, there's going to be a lot of rejection. And it's tough for these kids to take. I mean, it's tough not even for kids. WWE wannabe superstars were coming to these wrestling schools. They wanted to be the next Big Show. They wanted to be the next Steve Austin. And they get their asses kicked. And they walk out of there so dejected, and I'm so upset, and I was the best kid on my wrestling team. your heart goes out for them. There was a, we had a facility in Florida, WWE had a facility in Florida where young people could go if they were from local wrestling. Their local wrestling guy, because it may have been semi-professional in their market, would send them there. And 9 times out of 10, they got their butts kicked and they would have to go home. So you want to hope that there's something else for these kids besides wrestling, besides football, besides sports, but it's tough.
From a standpoint of opportunity, if we just stick with high school or youth sports, the need to specialize at a young age, the whole idea of travel teams, premier teams, and the fact that you have people out there taking highlights of 10-year-olds to build a highlight reel so that they could be accepted into some academy and maybe spend 3 weeks in Brazil learning soccer from somebody at Santos. I mean, my opinion, the media has a lot to do with driving those unfulfilled dreams. And so while sports can be inspiring, as we heard from J-Mac, that J-Mac story, which everybody resonates with, you have these other, the darker side. Here's the headlines from a newspaper. It could be sports page, could be front page. Drugs, murder, bullying, head injuries, racism. From your perspective, Jay, when you're having to sort of cover and balance those types of issues, the socioeconomic issues behind sports, how do you attack that?
I think from that standpoint, I mean, the way we go about it, I mean, this is on the pro level, but you were talking about the bullying. We were looking at it from the socioeconomic angle this week, and we've been writing stories and digging in on the families, like you were just mentioning, Lou, and talking to some families of children who have been bullied and have been bullied in high school and the pressures that they've gotten. Some have been from students. They've been bullied from students. Some, there have been talk that parents on the sideline have bullied them. But we haven't really had a balance on it. We've just been reporting it out and seeing where it goes. This is the story this week with Jonathan Martin in Miami is pretty fresh, and we are on top of that, and we're looking for new ways to go, but we just continue to report and see where it goes. But so far, we are always fair and balanced, and we're just talking to as many people as possible. You know, we're talking to sociologists, we're talking to psychologists. Like I said, we're talking to people on the ground, the family members, whether they are parents or friends of children who have heard that this is going on, you know, and we're trying to think, okay, can we write this, or can we not? But it's a serious issue.
So let's take it up a notch. College athletics for our two anchors over here. Amateurs, yes, no. Should we pay them? I mean, I'm talking about Big Ten, ACC, SEC. You know, we're not talking about, you know, Division III, where student athlete really is student first, athlete second. It just seems like this model continues to erupt. You've got just exorbitant rights fees being paid. There's with the digitization of sports, you've got games that we're never seeing the light of day are all being produced and distributed. You've got college-specific networks. You've got conference-specific networks. Shouldn't these kids get paid?
You know what? They should get paid, but it's not that easy. It's not that easy. If it were, that would be terrific. I am not a sit-on-the-fence kind of guy. I usually have strong opinion one way or the other, but I find this to be very difficult. You know, the value of a college education right now at a top-notch university, I mean, this is big-time money that people who can't play those sports, whether it's football or whatever, revenue-producing sports, they would never be able to go to that college, just economically. So to say they're not getting paid, I mean, they're getting this quality education that, right, if not for their skills on the field or on the ice, whatever, they would not normally get. That being said, they bring in a tremendous amount of revenue and television rights themselves. The NCAA got caught in a little pickle themselves with Johnny Manziel. They were marketing Texas A&M jerseys, just happened to be the number 2, which was, you know, Manziel's number. And is that fair? And that was brought up by Jay Billis, our guy, who got after the NCAA, and the NCAA immediately took it down off the website, the Manziel jersey. So it's a difficult call. I don't have the right answer. I would love to say that the value of a top-end education should be enough. But, you know, I'm not sure that's my place to say, actually. And the other aspect is policing it. Okay, let's pay them. Great. What are we paying them? All right, how much are we paying them? And then who's now going to enforce that they're only getting paid that much? Since we all believe many of them are getting paid right now something underneath the table.
And how do you delineate between, and I'll use college basketball as an example, Syracuse in a huge program, and Florida Gulf Coast University, who sneaks off a Cinderella-like season, makes it into the Sweet 16. I mean, how do you come up with a structure to compensate them? I do think it's quite ironic that EA Sports severs its agreement with the NCAA to manufacture the college football game anymore because they see what's coming. I mean, they use the likeness of the players on their video games, and this is going to be fascinating to see what happens in the next 1 or 2 years with this because there's no easy fix, as you said. Right. You've got to come up, if you're going to compensate them, come up with some kind of formula. But how do you, you got the big-time programs, you got the lesser programs that on occasion strike it big. It's a, that's a tough one.
Mm-hmm. And there will be more heat coming on the NCAA, no matter what the change is. One of the top law firms, Winston Strom, led by Jeff Kessler, they are starting their own unit that will start pursuing NCAA issues, where they will have clients that are the players. They could be high school players. They could be college players. They can be the universities, where any of those institutions think something has been wrong. They've been wronged. They want a grievance. Kessler's group at Winston Strom is going to start taking on the NCAA. And again, this isn't something that's going to just happen overnight, but it's going to start to trickle out. And again, change is coming.
Well, Kessler represented right. the players during sure. the NBA lockout, sure. so he knows how to make a buck.
And right, right.
He's out for something too.
So, exactly, but yeah. but you know, with the results that he gets, you know, whether it's with the NBA mm-hmm. or with the mm-hmm. NFL players,
yep.
you know, he sees there's this void, yeah. and he's whether you say
it,
right, right exactly mm-hmm. whether you say he's exploiting it, but he's right. a very smart and sharp
yep.
sharp guy. No firm has ever done this before,
yeah.
and so now I think you're going to see this, whether it's on the high school level or on the collegiate level,
yeah.
where these grievances are going to come up against the NCAA.
Mm-hmm. There's such strong opinions on both sides of the paying college players, a student athlete, right? It's different from, like, you know, you say, hey, there's so much talk about it, it's got to be coming. For example, the playoff system in college football, right? Mm-hmm. We knew it was only a matter of time. But you know what? It wasn't split. There was no one who said, you know what, let's not have a playoff system, right? It seemed like it was 95-5, everyone in favor of a playoff system. And this, from what I can tell from people I work with, Twitter accounts, this really seems to be a 50-50 kind of split, with a lot of people feeling, you know, my first point, which was mm-hmm. the quality of an education, you know, at some of these schools, mm-hmm. you know, it could be $100,000 a year, right? I mean,
right.
that seems like payment.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about the intersection of sports and commerce. You have these alternative sports. ESPN created a franchise, the X Games, which has gone global. Now they're scaling back a bit. But it clearly provided a platform and a venue for, let's just use alternative or X Game type athletes and sponsors to intersect. You see a company like Red Bull take that and extend it, you know, beyond. So now we're talking about, to me, commerce, alternative, crafted. Sounds a lot like wrestling. I mean, is it sport? Is it spectacle? Is it a contest? Or is it a consumer product grab?
It's all of the above. It's everything you just said. And at the end of the day, this is business. And it is like wrestling, because wrestling, oh, is wrestling fake? No, I don't care what you call it. It's scripted entertainment. But it is to make a buck at the end of the day. And so you have TV rights deals, and you have consumer products deals, and you have deals on the digital side, and you have sponsorship relationships. And the X Games is just the same thing, because I knew Rick Alessandri, who started
right.
it for you
right.
guys at ESPN. And ultimately, the goal is the same, Lou. It's to make a buck, and it's the same thing that the UFC and MMA did. They came out of, you know, they were small, and now they're bigger, and they're huge. And so if it's Red Bull is going to come up with the next thing, and soccer is trying really hard and coming up with more and more professional franchises, it's to make a buck at the end of the day.
And making a buck is, you know, the brilliance of the X Games from the ESPN perspective. You know, we pay $1.2 billion to the NFL per season. That's with a B. And whatever we pay Major League Baseball, we, in essence, invented the X Games.
Right.
There are no rights fees. I mean, that's the genius. You can't get programming anymore, live programming, without rights fees. I don't. Mm-hmm. World Series of Poker, I don't know if we pay.
I think you do.
We pay rights fees?
Yes, I think you do.
A little bit.
Is that
a sport? Just a little bit.
But X Games has been a tremendous success.
Yeah.
Certainly getting a younger demographic as well. Although, as you mentioned, we have scaled back a little bit.
Well, you know, the irony of the X Games is that for all of the effort that goes into producing the event, and of course, you know, my company was part of that, and I've been to a few where you see it's essentially a consumer's carnival. I mean, there happens to be some sports going on, but you can't get through the X Games without having been bombarded. If you're in that, I'll call it 12 to 28 demographic, it is like a kid in a candy store. You're getting free stuff, you're getting samples, you're getting all that stuff. And the irony is that of all, you know, there's probably only, what, 3 hours a night on air or something when there was probably 12 hours of competition. Now, it goes digital, it goes in archives, et cetera. But it was an event. You didn't have to pay for it. You paid for it by creating it.
Right.
But you don't have that big price tag. I've got one question that I want to ask, just as a generic. Don't think hard. Just give me what you first hit you. Favorite sports moment?
Favorite sports moment as a fan, when the Islanders won their first Stanley Cup in 1980, when I was probably 13 years old.
Islanders Cup.
Islanders
That's
Cup.
That's the best you could come up with.
That's what I would come up
with. Oh, did he say that? Oh, sorry. Donna.
All right, so you got to remember that I'm not a huge sports fan. I'm a sports business fan. So my best moment will be when Steve Austin came in and kicked Mr. McMahon's ass out of the hospital room. And he was in the hospital.
Love it.
Sports entertainment is.
John.
I would have to say growing up a big Miami Dolphins fan, and this is a minute moment in sports history, the Dolphins in the wild card game against the Chargers were getting clobbered right before halftime. The hook and lateral, Don Strock, Duriel Harris to Tony Nathan, touchdown, put Miami back in the game. That was one play, one moment that really stood out for me.
You guys remember that?
Yeah.
And let me have one and one B.
Yeah,
Lake Placid, 1980.
Yeah. There you go.
That's a good one.
Steve.
I was in the building the night the ball went through Buckner's legs.
Yes, he was. 86. He was a student here and went down there.
Yeah. My folks were cool enough to let me come home for the World Series, thinking I might never see the Mets win again. And I was in the press box that night, not working. And I was all by myself in my section of the press box because in those days, you know, that ball game was over. The Red Sox had it won. All the reporters were already downstairs getting ready, waiting outside the locker room to interview the players. So the ball goes through Buckner's legs. The Mets go on to win. I'm all by myself. I look around. There's nobody near me. And all of a sudden, everybody comes back up to rewrite their stories. And then the Mets go on to win in Game 7 after a rainout on the Sunday night. So, with the Buck being there for the Buckner game was
fucking. Okay, we'll turn it over to the audience for questions.
Hi, my name is Mike Tanzini. I'm a senior broadcasting major. My question's for Jay. The Redskins have been around for a long time. In recent comments by President Obama, do you think, because of these comments and the reports, should the Washington Redskins change their names because it is possibly deemed racist?
Well, the bottom line for this, and the reason Dan Snyder won't change it, is because the brand is worth so much money to him. So everybody and Obama, the president, has come down with his opinion, as have a lot of different political figures and people in the world of sports. But Dan Snyder has said that he is not going to change the name. He does not have to change the name. It is worth a lot of money to him, and I just don't think he's going to change it. Whether he should or he shouldn't, you know, that's not for me to say, but I don't think he's going to be changing it.
But the funny thing is, what are we all talking about? The Washington Redskins. He's getting so much press on this thing. And I interviewed with Snyder for a job years ago, and I'm telling you, he's loving this. Because this feeds right in, right, you guys?
Yeah, no question.
Know, he's loving
and
this.
And it's worth a lot of money to the NFL as well, not just to the Redskins.
Right. Yeah.
The NFL brand may say the right things, but the bottom line is that brand is worth a lot to the league.
Yes, Steve?
I think they changed the name. I think this is snowballing. And I don't know how soon it'll be. And at some point, I do believe they will change the name. Snyder will give his blessing at some point because he has to. The league will make it worth his while somehow. They will make up some of the money in new T-shirts and new hats and new jerseys. I just feel at some point, and again, this could still be 5 years away. Right. At some point, it'll be, you know what? This is just not worth hanging on to. We've made so many changes, so many teams for a variety of reasons. You guys won't remember this, but Washington's pro basketball team used to be the Bullets.
The Bullets, yeah.
And they went away from that, too. Now, it's not the same, nowhere near the same level, the tradition as the Washington Redskins. But, again, I'm in the minority here. And I'm good with that. I feel that will change one day.
Hi, my name is Ross Bentley. I'm a senior journalism major here. My question is for Donna. You worked in a business in the WWE where steroid use is prevalent and it's a big ongoing issue. Do you think that steroid use, performance-enhancing drug use, is and should be treated differently in sports entertainment than in competitive sports?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, it should and it is now treated very differently than it used to be. And when I left WWE in 11, and I actually looked on the website thinking that would be a question before I came out here, it's a three-strike rule now. You're caught, you're out for 30 days. You're caught again, you're out for 60 days, and then the third time you're gone. And the other thing is when you're caught and they do random testing, they're going to do a press release about it too. So the talent does not want to be dipping into the juice. I mean, it is not a good idea, and it is highly discouraged. Now, having said that, there's always going to be something that comes out, not only in wrestling, obviously, in sports, but it is so important that is not happening because it's a killer. I mean, forget about anything else. Forget about that it makes your game better. It's just, it's going to ultimately kill you. So it's no different in sports entertainment.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Moraima Capellan, and I'm a journalism and cinema and screen studies double major. My question is for Steve. How important is racial diversity in the broadcast sports industry? Where are we now, and where is it going?
I think ESPN is among the leaders in that. I mentioned, you know, we get this mission statement to serve all sports fans at every level. That, too, is on our mission statement. We are briefed quarterly about the Latino population in the United States, how it is exploding, how we are, I don't know if it's 25 years from now, from becoming a majority, and how they love their sports. And ESPN has taken a strong role in trying to be ahead of that. There's ESPN Deportes. It's a very popular station. We've mixed in a lot of Hispanic broadcasters on the domestic side as well. But ESPN is very much aware. And I think you see a balance. If you put on ESPN in terms of gender, race, ethnicity, ESPN is front and center. I feel like we do a much better job than a lot of other outlets as well. But it is top, top, top on our priority list. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Hey, guys. I'm Mike Ryan. I'm a junior communication major. And my question's for John. John, after covering so many famous golf tournaments, do you believe that golf is gaining more attention from the fans now than it did in the past? Have the crowds become larger at the tournaments? And do you think golf could ever become as popular as a sport like football?
Don't think it'll ever become nearly as popular as football. Nothing will, certainly not the NFL. The Tiger factor certainly played into golf's popularity, although I think that somewhat is on a downswing. At the tournaments, at the championships, and specifically the majors, and I'll exclude the Masters because that's a completely different circumstance there. They are really pushing the threshold for attendance. We saw a little bit of that in Rochester. Oak Hill can only handle really comfortably 25,000 fans on that course. They had 35, 40 upward of that, and it's just crazy. And if you're familiar with golf and watching any of the major in Rochester in August, you heard a lot of screaming as guys were teeing off. Reflected poorly really on our community, even though a lot of the fans weren't even from Rochester. They came from all over the country and the world. But they, in my opinion, oversold it, and it resulted in some pretty rough behavior by the galleries out there, and the golfers were turned off. So I think the popularity from a viewing standpoint on TV has almost maxed out with Tiger's fame and his dominance. But from selling tickets, they will do anything they can to make money. They sell a lot in chalets, corporate chalets that they do at these events. and they're really pushing the threshold as far as attendance at the event for the majors. Augusta aside, because they have set rules, they make their own rules, and they're very stringent.
Right. Hi, my name is Seamus Lyman. I'm a junior journalism major, I'm also news editor for the Oswegonian. My question is mainly for Jay. How do you go from covering sports in the United States to going and covering sports internationally?
Well, we have reporters all over the world who will cover these different events, whether you're in Tokyo or Sydney or in Brazil. There are different factors that come into play. Like if we have reporters in Beijing, we don't use bylines, things like that. When we are reporting out of South Africa and also in Rio, as we're getting ready for the Olympics and for the World Cup, which are coming up, we deal a lot more with security. That's not really from the journalism side of things, but there's a lot more red tape involved when we are sending people abroad to cover events globally. But the stories are the stories in general.
Hi, guys. My name is Marlena. I'm a journalism major, and I'm a junior here. My question's for Donna again. Sorry, guys.
It's all about the women, girls.
So how does WWE combat the image of being a sport versus entertainment? How do you think it should be perceived?
It's both. Without a doubt, it's both. It's entertainment because it's not real. Did you guys know that? It's scripted. But you get those guys in the ring, and I don't think anybody here would say anything differently. These are athletes. These are serious athletes. You're not going to jump from the third story into that ring unless you know how to fall, and you're a stuntman, and you're an athlete, and you're going to throw someone over your shoulder. So it really is a combination of sports and entertainment, I would say, and I think anybody would agree with that.
Steve will have highlights next Monday. When it's on there, then I'll believe some
we
of that.
We haven't shown, I don't recall any highlights there.
You've been listening to the Dr. Louis B. O'Donnell Media Summit, recorded at SUNY Oswego on November 6th, 2013. Brought to you by WRVO Public Media.